you like to diversify your investment portfolio? Bede Dwaek will tell us how to do this. What's so special about Bede Dwaek is that he co-founded Bluestone Flagship Investors to give busy professionals access to a variety of vetted cash flowing real estate investing opportunities they could use to protect themselves from economic turbulence while building long-term wealth, where he invests right beside you. And he is also the co-founder of a fractional family office that will allow tech professionals to diversify their investments. And he will tell us all about this today. So, BD, tell us about how can an entrepreneur, how can a tech professional diversify their investment portfolio, and what kind of investments do you generally invest in?
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu. Mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
Sure. Well, Lily, thank you for the opportunity to be in on part of your podcast. I would say before we dive into how, let's just try to understand what is the typical, what is the norm for a tech professional. And, you know, me, myself, I've actually worked in tech as a chip designer for 25 years. And the journey starts as just you go to school, you graduate, and you start working on techie stuff. And, you know, while it's a decent job and you start getting paid and start getting stock, all of a sudden you find yourself too much weight in terms of public markets, because, you know, a lot of retirement is saved into the 401k, which is stock. You're earning your company public stock. And all of a sudden, when you start looking at your overall net worth and your overall portfolio, while it's growing, it's high at higher risk because it's very much influenced by public markets. So the first thing to look at is like, okay, how does a tech professional have to look into diversifying themselves outside the stock market? For me, it was really more becoming initially as an accidental landlord, where I thought, hey, it's a great idea to buy a house and have people become as my roommates, as my tenants. Slowly after that, I moved out of it. I didn't want to have any more roommate tenants, and started really enjoying the aspect of scaling up my real estate portfolio. So one of the things that I went in the journey was like, hey, how can I really take some money out of my stocks and put it into real estate? And the initial thought was mainly, hey, I want to diversify. But it went a little bit further when I started understanding, hey, what are some of the other benefits of not just diversification, but actually owning real estate in terms of appreciation, cash flow, and depreciation. And later on, you know, it came a full story as I really started to understand taxes. So it's not really just about earning. It's really about how much you end up keeping and then how will you grow it. So investing, while it is an aspect of, you know, being able to take your seeds, plant them, and have them grow, it's also important for you to understand, hey, how much of that you're giving up to Uncle Sam, or I'm not sure what you call it in the UK, the equivalent of Uncle Sam. But effectively, you know, it's a matter of investing, but conscious investing in the sense of what are you investing in? How does it help you diversify your overall portfolio? How does it help you on your taxes? And how does it actually help you in terms of building your long-term wealth over time?
Thank you. So property investment is one of your potential investments. And what strategy are you using specifically? Because, I mean, a lot of people I know are property investors. And I mean, they use all, like, so many different strategies. So what's your preferred strategy that you, let's say, if someone was to want to collaborate with you, so they can diversify their investment portfolio, where would you be likely to help them invest?
Sure. So from a big picture perspective, most people, when they start with real estate, they start with buying a property and renting it out. But at some point, as they start growing their real estate portfolio, it becomes very difficult to scale up. You know, when you start having more than four or five different properties, it becomes a nightmare to actually manage. So that's when you actually start switching from residential real estate into more commercial real estate. And these are the areas that actually allowed me to scale. So while I started my, you know, investment career, not career, but I'm saying investment portfolio in real estate in residential, very quickly, as I realized it's really difficult to scale up from residential, so I started getting into commercial real estate. And commercial real estate has a whole lot of different products. I mean, we invest in things from commercial retail to storage to industrial to, you know, actually multifamily, which is considered actually also commercial. So a whole lot of different products, but a lot of these products are managed, meaning the actual properties is managed, have their own property management built in. And typically as a commercial property, your landlord responsibility is a lot lower. So it could be more in development, it could be more in the value add space, everything that you want to invest within real estate, believe it or not, it's quite broad, has a different level of metrics in terms of return, risk, tax benefits, appreciation. So again, it's not a one size fit all, and it's really about looking at your overall portfolio and understand what portion of that portfolio you want to be managed and what portion of that portfolio you want it to be, you know, not managed, basically. What's self-managed and what's actually sponsor-managed.
Thank you. So why should someone go with this kind of property investment strategy? And is there any benefit from an ROI perspective or from the fact that it's actually passive property investment?
So the reason you want to go more passive is because at some point it becomes very difficult to scale. You know, as you continue, let's just say, to work in tech, your net worth keeps going up. But if you're trying to maintain a 30% of your net worth in real estate, it's not scalable for you to have one property, two property, three property. So that's where you start to really balance your real estate portfolio by having passive investments. Then when you're looking at passive investments, the one I prefer more is usually a value add, meaning you're buying a slightly older property where you're really buying it at, you know, 60 cents on the dollar because it's older. It needs some work, needs some rehab. And then, you know, the operator who's really expert in the area, expert in the submarket, has the construction team, the ability to actually rehab that property, improve its potential, improve its income, cash flow it, and at some point sell it as it actually reaches highest potential. So when I'm looking at passive investments property, typically my goal is like buy low and sell high, just like you would trade a stock. You want to be able to buy it at a lower valuation and sell it high. There are other avenues where people invest into a ground up development and so forth. I tend to not see the value, you know, from a risk adjusted return when I think about a ground up development versus a value add play, you know, buying an older property and improving it. But again, it's very subjective and it's very sub-market specific. You know, a real estate that you would buy in California is very different than the type of real estate you want to buy in Texas, very different than in Florida. And that's also very different when you start looking at international properties as well. Because at some point, some people like to diversify their real estate portfolio outside the U.S., not just within the U.S. And that's something that actually I've personally done, is having assets in the U.S. as well as assets outside.
Thank you. Are there any particular areas or states where you tend to invest your investment portfolio?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's very specific to the sub, not just the state, but actually the sub market within a state. So, for example, we like the state of Texas. The reason is it's a very property landlord rules. So the rules are very friendly to property landlords. Versus if you look at California and you're trying to do things like multifamily, we stay away from that because it tends to be very, very tenant friendly. Or New York City, for example, tends to be. So depending on the type of assets, if we're buying a commercial retail property, you know, we have specific vectors in terms of population density, growth, jobs. We look at other things as average income. What are some of the demographics? So for every specific investment, might not lend itself to all the different submarkets. So in a big nutshell, we focus on growth areas where there's positive net migration, where there's a decent amount of population and decent income. But then when you start double clicking, it's like, okay, which part of Dallas do you want to be in? You want to be in North Dallas? You want to be in South Dallas for this type of asset? Then you start really looking at, hey, what are some of the new developments happening in the area? What is the competition? Where is the growth? Where is the demand? So believe it or not, real estate is very, very submarket specific. So it's not like there's one investment that fits all. For every particular submarket, we are looking for specific type of investment products. And for each investment product, we're looking at specific type of metrics that it needs to achieve. And that's why we started really using AI to vet, because as we started connecting and getting the deal flow in terms of various different investments, we found out it's like there's so much flood of investments, but there's very few that are good. And that's when in 2021, me and my co-founder, considering us being tech guys, you know, quite natural on being able to use AI, we started actually developing a lot of our AI filtering schemes to be able to take deals and filter them down to the specific ones that we like, where we like these specific markets, these specific products, and then use that as a first level to try to find, okay, these are the best investments being offered in front of us. Now let's go run the due diligence to see, hey, are these worthwhile for us to deploy in capital?
Thank you. Tell us about other investments that you generally suggest to tech professionals so they can diversify their investment portfolio.
Sure. So what we start with, we say, hey, there's the public markets and then there's the private markets. And then, you know, or people call it alternatives. But, you know, when we want to diversify out of the public markets, you say, okay, what's in the alternative space? So one part we say is real estate. It moves slow, but it's consistent. It has a whole lot of tax benefit. But then at some point, you're like, hey, my portfolio needs to have a little bit more cash flow, because typically real estate is not very cash flow heavy. And in order for you to actually be able at some point to become job optional, be able to say, hey, I want to exit my tech job, I want to focus full time on other things, you need to actually have the cash flow to replace your salary or to replace your income. And that's where we start looking a little bit more at what we call private credit. Private credit is, you know, we can think about it more as debt fund or debt lending. Basically, we take our capital, we lend it to investors or companies and so forth. We prefer within private credit, real estate back lending. So when we're lending out people who are buying properties, we can lend them out on a specific terms where we lend them a specific loan to value. For us, that actually, even though it doesn't have appreciation, but it has a really nice cash flow. So when you start blending in some investment that gives you high appreciation, some investments give you cash flow, some investments give you combination of moderate cash flow and depreciation, which is tax benefit, everything else, you try to kind of start to formulate yourself a portfolio. You know, that is completely not attached to the public market. So whether Nvidia stock goes up or Nvidia stock goes down, or the S&P goes up, or S&P goes down, or somebody tweets whatever on the on Twitter, you're not necessarily being affected with a whole lot of gyration that's happening in the public markets. So private credit is definitely a good one. We like it because it gives a lot of cash flow, because you need to have some level of cash flow in your portfolio. Just like people say, hey, stocks and bonds give you cash flow, stocks give you appreciation. The same thing when we start looking at in the alternative space. And then other things were like, hey, at some point we need some level of growth vehicles. And that's when we actually like to invest in angel startups. You know, we're actually go vet a whole lot of different startups, especially startup founders that we like. We think they have a really good idea or a good product, or what we call them MVP, market validated product. And then not only that we want to invest in their startup, but we want to be the smart strategic capital in their capital stack to really open up more doors for them. So our proximity here being in Silicon Valley is just, we're seeing a whole lot of deal flow in tech. And for us, that gives us a very unique advantage to say, okay, let's vet the various different startups. And then, hey, let's take a little bit amount of risk in a portfolio of a few different startups. And as these startups go into the next phase, where they go to like a Series A or a Series B, we can double our investment because now it becomes a lower risk vehicle. So for us, when we're looking for growth, we like the startup and the angel investing. When we're looking for cash flow, we like the private credit. And when we're looking for like a nice stability, growth, continuous, you know, where you want to deploy majority of your capital, we like real estate, specifically commercial real estate.
Thank you. How do you reduce the risk of your investment when you do angel investing?
That's a topic and a whole thesis on its own. I think the key thing when you're doing angel investing is to look at the three key criteria, and they are in the following order. The first one is the founder. You really need to vet the founders. And it's a lot harder to vet first-time founders. It's a lot easier to vet second-time founders. So really need to understand the founders. And you need to make sure that the team, the management team, the three founders or the two founders you're looking for, have the right skill set and the experience to really execute the vision. The next level, once you fully vet the founders, you say, okay, how big is this market that they're going after? You know, is it is it exciting? Is it a big market? Is there growth? Or, you know, like, for example, we started looking at different AI companies back in 2020. It was still very little spoken about it, but it's, again, it was still new. We knew there's going to be a market. We knew there's going to be some level of momentum. So we knew at some point, some people will be ahead of others in AI, and some companies want to do catch up. And then we knew that the larger companies are always going to come and start swallowing some of the little ones so they can get a dose to catch up on AI. So we look at the market. Hey, is there enough market? Is there enough demand? Mainly in the uptick. There's very few times you invest into a startup that might become an Uber, or that might become a Google, or that might become an Amazon. It's super rare to be able to find that. So you have to be a little bit more practical. You know, at the end of the day, you're like, hey, I'm going to invest into the startup. They're going to grow this product. They're going to solve problems. But at some point, is there going to be a big fish that's going to come and swallow them because they see value in their technology or the direction everybody else want to go in that direction? So that's the market. And the third factor we say, it's like, okay, how good is their product? You know, are they truly solving a problem, and are they solving it better than anybody else? So again, to recap, it's the management team, the market that they're going after, and then the last thing is the product. Typically, most people that never invest in startups and so forth, they start the other way around. They get excited about the product, and they don't pay as much attention to the market if there's a really need for something like this, or it's just a cool idea. You know, and the third they completely miss out is, hey, do these management team have what it takes to actually execute this vision?
Thank you. Why would you say there are companies that you can say reach a relatively good level in terms of like raising millions and then fail? How can an angel investor avoid that? Or how can an investor avoid basically losing all of their money? What else needs to be put in place? Because I'm sure that, you know, a lot of investors that have a lot of experience also occasionally mess up really big time in terms of investing in the wrong startup, or in a startup that was really, really promising, but something somehow goes wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there's always things go wrong in a startup. I mean, I was part of three startups, of which two have failed. One was acquired by Cisco. And again, that's over a 25-year span career. So not all startups make it. And, you know, if you look at the success chance of a startup, is under 5%. So again, the expectation for any investor going into an angel, understand, hey, this is a high risk domain, you know, but you're signing in smaller checks. The way we look at it is like, hey, I might not want to put $1 million in a startup. You know, I might want to put maybe a $200,000 startup, where individually I'm not putting 200,000, I'm maybe putting 20,000 along other, you know, 10 investors in Bluestone. The reason we do that, because it allows us not only just invest into one startup, we can invest in 10 startups collectively. So now we're really spreading the seeds. But when we're investing in a startup, we don't want to just be, like I said, the capital to enable that startup. Typically, we need to have full confidence that the management team has what it takes to actually make it successful. And not a lot of investors really take the time to get to know the founders and understand, hey, okay, there's the guy that is maybe the sausage maker in terms of the technology. But okay, there has to be the guy that knows how to run a company, the operational guy. But there also has to be the guy who needs to sell this technology. At the end of the day, yeah, if you have cool technology, you can't sell it, it's useless. If you cannot run the operations of the company and hire good people and grow your team, again, it's not going to have success. So the factors that's going to make a lot of startups fail are quite clear. And then for us, we just try to see, okay, how can we minimize that? And then how can we be strategic capital when we're investing into the startup early on, be able to guide them, be able to bring on advisors, be able to bring on, you know, that's kind of what we call ourselves strategic capital, you know, that's going to open up doors for those. So let's just say out of the 17 people in Bluestone and so forth, we have a startup in a specific SaaS domain. Well, typically part of the reason why we would invest in this is because we have two or three experts in the group that are in this space that can actually open up more doors. So when that startup wants to do a demo for a Google, or that startup wants to do a good demo for Amazon, we have what it takes to make these phone calls and set up those meetings. And not every startup founder, especially if they're a younger founder or first time around, has the ability to do that. And that's really kind of, you know, you need to make sure that we're investing into a startup where you understand their domain, you understand their field, but you could also be an enabler for them. If you cannot be the immediate enabler, who in your network can actually open up more doors for them? So that's always strategic to be able to do in a startup. And that's how you improve the chances of success of the startup, not just to protect your small investment, because you really want to see that startup actually take off and grow and go into the right direction. The second part you want to consider is typically you're investing a smaller check in the seed, but there are specific milestones. So you want to be holding these founders accountable to their milestones, to their goals. Now, business plans might change, strategy might change, but you're pretty much up to speed with what's going on. That's why you're meeting with them quarterly or sometimes a little bit more, like maybe monthly, sometimes it's biweekly. It does take a little bit more high touch. People think, hey, I'm just going to write a check into the startup and one day it's going to be huge money. Well, those are really rare. Those are really rare occasions. You have to be part of the capital stack where you're really opening up doors, or at a minimum part of a group that is actually already doing that and enabling that for that startup. At the end of the day, there's a lot of headwind in any startup. And for us, when we go in as strategic capital, our goal is to give direction, give advice, open up more doors. And that's how you improve the chances of success of a startup.
Thank you. Tell us some of the investment deals that you're proudest of, where you invested in something that really worked out, or some of your investors that you advised or you mentored, they had some big success.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've all had scars in the terms of startups that failed. But I'll tell you what's interesting, instead of talking about the glory of the ones that made a lot of money, let's talk about the learning experiences from the ones that I failed. I'll tell you, I've worked in a startup when I was early on in my career from 1998 till 2004. And we grew from zero to 20 million back to zero. And even though it was never materialized into an exit, it had potential for an exit, but so many things happened. And that really made me realize, it's like, wow, so much has happened, yet we continue. You know, I mean, 6 years in the life of a startup is a long time, especially when you only raised like $1 million and you get to 20 million in sales. But it really taught me, it's like, wow, here's all the challenges that happens in a startup. You learn more from, like I said, from the failing ones than you learn from the successful ones. I've also had a startup where it got acquired, by Cisco, and that I was part of, actually. I worked in that startup. And for me, frankly, I realized that me working in that startup versus an investor investing in that startup, believe it or not, the investors made a lot more money. An investor, if they put in a $100,000 check, they would have actually collected $1 million. And when I looked at the actual time and effort and everything else and the stock option that I got out of it, barely skid the surface. That's really made me go back and re-scratch my head. I was like, am I really going about the startup the wrong way? Because here's a startup out of two failing startups that I've been part of in Silicon Valley that actually was a success. You know, it was acquired. Yet at the end of the day, when you look at the return for me versus the return for the investors, I realized the investors did a lot less work than I did working at the startup, yet they actually end up reaping a lot of the benefits. So that's really what opened me up about investing a lot more into startup. And I would say, I'm not really investing into startup. I'm investing in the founders at the end of the day. You're really going to be investing into the people, because good founders can take an okay idea and make it great, versus bad founders could take an amazing idea and run it to the ground.
Thank you. What other investment suggestions you give to your investors to diversify their investment portfolio?
Yeah, like what I spent today a whole lot of time talking about startup, I would say that's a very small part of the portfolio. I don't necessarily give investment advice on public site, because I'm not licensed to give investment advice, but I can talk more about what my investment strategy is and a lot of my investment thesis are. So typically, I like commercial real estate because it's consistent, it has growth, it has cash flow, and it has a whole lot of tax benefit. Now, as it actually spits out that little amount of cash flow that it produces, you know, I don't really need that smaller amount of cash flow. You know, think about it as 4%, 5% cash flow from whatever you invested. So if you put in $1 million, you're looking at about $50,000 capital. Not tremendous, but it's consistent and it has a high probability of achieving it. But what I really like about that is I can take that 5% of cash flow that I'm collecting from my commercial real estate and use that as risk capital to roll into a startup. So this way, I'm not taking really hard earned money that I've paid a whole lot of taxes on. and then, you know, taking a bet on it in a startup. I'm actually, you know, taking my hard-earned money, deploying it into a commercial real estate project where it's getting growth, I'm getting tax benefit, I'm getting cash flow. And then out of the cash flow for my commercial real estate, that's the stuff that I'm willing to take a bet on in terms of a startup. Because you might want to think about it, is like you might put in, you know, 10 different startup investments, of which two would make it and eight would fail, right? And you're hoping that the two will make it will be enough to actually compensate for the eight that failed and be able to get you that higher multiple return. A good success in a startup story is 10x to 100x, you know, off your investment, especially if you do what we call follow-on. Follow-on is you invested in the seed, they got to a certain milestone, now they went to a venture capital, they raised a Series A, you go into a Series A with a larger check, you know, now they go into the next level of valuation, they get a Series B, you might want to choose to get into Series B or just cash out your chips. But if you've been in one of those cycles where you went into pre-seed to seed to a Series A and then exit, you've actually done well for yourself in terms of that investment. But at the end of the day, you want to be taking good money and putting it into higher risk money. You have to get into a startup understanding that, hey, this is money they're going to lose. But at the end of the day, my money is fully invested in real estate. It's continuing to see the growth. It's continuing to see the tax benefits. And I'm really taking that smaller sum of the cash flow that I'm getting out of my real estate, you know, the net of the rent that's left out, and roll that into actually a higher risk vehicle like a startup.
Thank you. Are there any other types of investments that you do, like, for example, in crypto or digital assets, NFTs, things like that, or something else?
Yeah, I mean, I do have about 10% allocation of my personal investments into public markets. You still need to have, but for that, I actually manage it myself, meaning I actually trade it. You know, I'm a level 330 certified option trader. And I wake up every day in California time, 5 a.m., so I can set up my trades and manage that. But more recently, been interested a little bit more into adding some level of allocation into crypto, but not more as a trade, but more as, hey, I would like to get some level of exposure to crypto in the overall. And that's where we're looking actually at a crypto hedge fund. It's a hedge fund that actually algorithmically trades Bitcoin and Ether and in a dynamic fashion. So a lot of the trading that's happening in that, it's purely algorithmic, meaning it has no emotions. So basically taking mathematical models, build mathematical models into software, and the software job is to actually just go dynamically trade Bitcoin and Ethereum. And with that, actually, we've been seeing some really interesting success. It's a smaller allocation, but it's just a way to kind of get us a little bit more exposed to the crypto space.
Thank you. Are there any other types of investments that you make? Or if not, tell us what else you would like tech professionals to know about diversifying their portfolio.
I think that there's a whole lot of learning associated with how to go build yourself your own portfolio. I felt like no matter wherever I seeked advice, whether it's a certified public accountant or a CPA or a financial planner, they were never able to kind of meet exactly what I was looking for. And a lot of times they were just trying to put you into, hey, just make as much money as you can into your retirement and then put it in stocks and bonds and withdraw money at 4%. Now, that requires you to work for 65, and if you want to be able to live the type of lifestyle that we're living now, you will probably need to have like $5 to $10 million of a pie to be able to pull out 4% a year and live on. I did not want that model. You know, I wanted to actually have a model where I can, exit early from tech. I retired at 43, and that allowed me to kind of take my money, build my own knowledge, and go and invest into alternatives and different areas. I was fortunate enough to invest in real estate early on and have good idea about what to invest and what not to invest in real estate. But I'll tell you one mistake a lot of tech professionals do is their level of financial literacy is very small. Even with an MBA, I thought my financial literacy was actually small, because you don't really learn a whole lot about what you should be doing. Maybe if you have a master's in finance, you have a little bit more insight, but I'll tell you, as a tech professional, there's very little being taught in terms of financial literacy. So I would say, take the time to really, before you invest into things, is to invest in your own knowledge. Invest into your own education about your financial literacy, because that would open up more doors and gives you a better idea where is your risk tolerance, where you should have more allocation into. Look what others are doing. And at the end of the day, it's, you know, I value the opinion of a professional that went through the experience more than a professional that has certificates on the wall. For me, I definitely value the experience more than I value, hey, this person has a Series 65 license, or he has a certified financial planning license. Because a lot of the academic programs that are done in that space, it's super cookie cutter, and it doesn't really cover a whole lot of areas that people that should be looking into. I think you're on mute.
Are there any other way to protect your investment portfolio? For example, I know that if you invest in movies in the UK, there are some government protections where I think if you lose your money, you get it back, or it's somehow protected. Are there any other protections that when you invest in different things that you mentioned, is there anything kind of like available to protect you from like losing all of your money, or there's pretty much like nothing?
I guess that's why your Hollywood is not really taking off, because you guys are not producing good enough movies. No, I'm just kidding. The movie thing is quite interesting. I only invest in things I understand. Even though, you know, when you start to become a full-time investor, which is what I was starting 2020 or 2019, end of 2019, there's a lot of what I call a shiny object syndrome. And you have to kind of hold yourself back and structure yourself into a discipline. You know, yeah, there's going to be this shiny object syndrome. You want to invest in everything that gets thrown at you because it sounds cool, it sounds interesting. But what I found to be helpful is, you know, I put myself into a lot of masterminds and a lot of network of fund managers, you know, full-time investors, high net worth individuals, where we actually take specific investments and we actually spend about 2 weeks analyzing it and looking at it from every corner. And then we meet weekly, where we spend hours a week discussing things. And then we work in the background and we share. Sitting there and doing that level of due diligence on every investment, it gets to build you a bit of discipline that is really needed to understand what you're investing into. I think the biggest problem you could do is invest in things that you don't understand, especially when you start reading some of those legal documents. At the end of the day, you signed a 70-page legal document by the investor operator, right? Whoever is putting on the investment goes, pays the lawyer $30,000 to come up with that legal document. Do you think that legal document is going to protect your interest as an investor, or is going to protect their interest as an operator? I think it's quite clear. So unfortunately, yeah, there's not a whole lot of protection. So you really need to be watching out for yourself. And that's why being in rooms, being speaking to other investors, being around family offices, sharing with them our deal flow, they share their deal flow. We sometimes do cross due diligence. We individually vet it. They individually vet it. We sit down with their CIOs and discuss why we like this investment opportunities. Tends to give you a little bit more caliber in terms of understanding, you know, why should you do this investment? So if you think you only know 70 or 80% about this investment, it's not good enough. You have to get to the point where you're comfortable with it, 90%. And to start, don't invest. My rule number one is like, don't invest what you can't afford to lose. So when you're signing a check for 100,000 or 500,000 or a million, whatever it is for yourself, nobody wants to lose money, but you need to be comfortable that, hey, sometimes there's a certain scenario that might happen, you might lose it. And you have to be okay with that. It's not going to be a life-changing event. That's why in many cases, we have a lot of people want to come and join us in Bluestone, and we just don't feel like they meet the criteria, and not just in terms of net worth or mindset, but in terms of being able to take on a loss. You know, luckily, we've been doing really well with all our investments. We haven't had much distress, even though commercial real estate overall as a sector has been hurting. But for us, we're actually looking at it as a great opportunity because it's a chance for us to buy because everything's on sale right now. You know, in 22, 23, we actually paused investing onto the equity side of commercial real estate because we said, hey, these deals are not penciling. Why should we go deploy capital when these deals are not making sense? So instead, we actually switched to the debt side, you know, started investing in private credit, you know, realized like 15, 16, 17% per year on private credit. We paused on it. And that's kind of how, you know, every year we come up with investment thesis. We decide, hey, here are the areas that are interesting in the investment space in real estate. Here's the thing, there are certain things in investment space in private credit. And then throughout the deal, we're constantly looking and evaluating various different opportunities to step into. We're not in a rush to deploy capital. We're all about deploying the right capital in the right deals and make sure that we have the right level of allocation. And ensuring, you know, minimizing our downside risk.
Thank you. For private credit, what are the range of sums that you could deploy if someone needed private credit?
Yeah, so So typically, we like, the investment in private credit. We're working actually with a group that do all the vetting for the commercial deals. We only like to invest into asset-based private credit, meaning they do hard money loans for real estate. Typically, the lending criteria is 60% LTV, meaning 60% loan to value. So if somebody's trying to buy $1 million property, you know, we're only willing to lend them up to 60%. The reason is we want to have a little bit of margin, because if they default, we want to be able to acquire that property and sell it as a distressed property with 20% and be able to recuperate our money. So it's not necessarily just about, you know, how much, but it's really about, does it fit really the buy box? And the buy box is 1 to 5 million loan. We typically, a lot of these loans that we do, considering it's a private credit, is not a long-term loan. People are coming in for the private credit because they need 6 months before they can get the property stabilized and get a standard refinance into a standard bank loan. So for us, it's, you know, a lot of these deals are like 6 months to a year, very higher interest rate. We charge them points up front, but typically we're only paying 60% loan to value or loan to cost effectively in order to protect our interest in terms of, hey, if they default. But you're really, private credit is interesting because you really need to understand the borrower. Just like in a startup, you have to understand the founder. In a private credit, you really need to understand the borrower. You have to look at their balance sheet. You have to look at their assets. You have to look at not just at the property that you're collateralizing. Sometimes you might ask them to sign a personal guarantee or ask them to collateralize another asset as well in order to bring the LTV. So it's a little bit tricky. It's not a domain that you want to do it yourself. So that's why we work with a professional that they underwrite loans. And then they send us the loans that they're trying to underwrite, and we deploy capital into that. And then we have a revenue share profit in terms of the returns that we get.
Thank you. What's the best way for someone to kind of connect with you in case they have really good investment deals? Is it better for them to send you like a long page of stuff that they have? Or like, what's the best way for them to actually reach out to you and get a response?
Yeah, so depends. It's in which domain. If they do have an investment opportunity in a commercial real estate, you know, let's just say this is a multi-million-dollar deal, I would say reach out directly on email or through social media and, you know, LinkedIn, and introduce yourself. We get on a call and then we'll go from there. But if it's something where it's like a little bit smaller, like, hey, somebody's looking for money for a startup and all that, we actually, work with other intermediaries that people submit their startup profiles into their platform. And then we run our criteria to see, okay, which ones of these startups match for us in terms of what we're looking for. And we would actually reach out for them and say, hey, we are interested in having a little bit further talk for you guys. So typically, you know, because these are much smaller check sizes, and as you can tell, you know, there's like thousands and thousands of startup founders think that their startup is the best thing. We're saying, okay, just go apply for it, drop it into the standard platform that we have to actually absorb your deal. And then from there, we would actually evaluate and see if there's a match. Ideally, we are looking for strategic interest. So if we cannot open up more doors for that startup, even though it could be a great startup with great founders, great idea, if we cannot influence it in positive ways, it's probably not a thing for us. So we only invest in things we truly understand.
Thank you. Tell us where property investors and entrepreneurs can connect with you.
Sure. Again, LinkedIn is very, I'm quite active, you know, Beadwake on LinkedIn. Sometimes it does get overwhelming, but now we have actually an assistant to handle a little bit of the traffic that's coming in and prioritize. That's probably the easiest way. You can also reach us on our website, bfi-fund.com. So that's Bluestone Flagship Investor. Hyphenfund.com, BFI-fund.com.
Thank you.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.